I want to say something about the drink.
Session 225, The Gospel According to the Blues, 12 Gates to the Inner City. The presenter will be Paul Swenson. Respondent will be Mark England. By way of introduction, Paul is a poet, journalist, teacher, editor, and blues enthusiast. He is currently nearing completion of a book manuscript dealing with an environmental and free speech dispute between two gutsy housewives and a multi-million dollar corporation. He is the author of one published poetry collection, Iced at the Board, Burned at the Stake, and his second poetry collection, In Sleep and Other Poems, is awaiting publication. He will be followed by Mark England as a respondent. Mark is the son of Eugene England. I guess he gets introduced that way frequently. He is a painter, not only of buildings, but of landscapes. He, as an entrepreneur, he and his wife started Dulce Gelato, and he lives in Salt Lake and is an historian and colloquially a troublemaker by his own definition. So we'll turn the time over to Paul.
So you got to hear a snatch of the late and yes, great Dave Van Ronk, blues and gospel singer, and the title for the paper came from that song, 12 Gates to the City. The Gospel According to the Blues, 12 Gates to the Inner City. Thank you for being here. News of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. came to me in the backyard of a single man. I was home teaching in an inner city neighborhood of Salt Lake City in 1968. He had heard the report on the radio. I can't remember what I said or if my home teaching companion and I were able to finish our assignment that night, but it was a hard blow that sent me home stunned and heartsick. It was a beautiful spring evening that had suddenly turned dark. Single and in my early 30s, I lived in an upstairs room of a two-story family residence whose beautifully coiffed, white-haired matriarch, Delilah Knutson, was a dynamo of vitality and kindness. I had a record collection of folk, gospel, blues, old-timey, and bluegrass that had schooled me in the bittersweet musical traditions of ecstasy and sorrow. My street, 600 South, would later be renamed Martin Luther King Boulevard. Martin King's writings had connected me with the wellsprings of my own religious tradition in a way that I was only beginning to understand. I had a worn-out cat copy of a King paperback, The Strength to Love, that seemed very much like scripture to me. My calling in the Ninth Ward of Liberty Stake in the middle of the 1960s was as a teacher of the young adult class in what was then called the Mutual Improvement Association, MIA, where M-men and gleaners, as they were called, quaintly called, were struggling to understand their respective places in the LDS Church. Using The Strength to Love as a supplement to the M-men and gleaner manual, I sometimes quoted King's words as the powerful testimony of an anonymous Christian leader that I believed held relevance for a generation of young people growing up in an exciting but turbulent era. He wrote, "At times we may feel that we do not need God. But on the day when the storms of disappointment rage, winds of disaster blow, and the tidal waves of grief beat against our lives, if we do not have a deep and patient faith, our emotional lives will be ripped to shreds. There is so much frustration in the world because we have relied on God's lowercase rather than God. We have genuflected before the God of science, only to find that it has given us the atomic bomb, producing fears and anxieties that science can never mitigate. We have worshipped the God of pleasure, only to discover that thrills play out and sensations are short-lived. We have bowed before the God of money, only to learn that there are such things as love and friendship that money cannot buy, and that in a world of possible depressions, stock market crashes, and bad business investments, money is a rather uncertain deity. These traditions, these transitory gods are not able to save us or bring happiness to the human heart. Only God is able. If it is faith in Him that we must rediscover. With this faith, we can transform bleak and desolate valleys into sunlit paths of joy and bring new light into the dark caverns of pessimism." That's from page 51 in The Strength to Love. I was well aware of the risk I was taking in smuggling a text from a Black Baptist pastor into MIA instruction. To identify the author of these words as the controversial civil rights leader then stirring up a nonviolent revolution in the American South more than a decade before the LDS Church was to begin to fully come to grips with long-time racist policies by accepting a priesthood revelation to Spencer W. Kimball, such action could be to court trouble. But I carefully kept the source of these supplemental teachings to myself, and was gratified that at least a few young Mormons in the class found the quotations from a leader outside their own religious tradition both provocative and inspiring. As a general assignment reporter at the Deseret News, a decade older than most of the class members. I was more directly exposed to the implications of the spiritual and social upheaval then emanating from southern locales with such evocative place names as Selma, Birmingham, Jackson. In 1963, my colleagues and I had taken calls on the News City desk from dozens of alarmed Utahns who were convinced that a busload of young, antagonistic black men had rolled into Salt Lake City with the express purpose of invading Temple Square. The rumors ran rampant for several days, and some readers found it difficult to accept the newspaper's reported verdict that they were spurious. Fortunately, the dispiriting impact of these phone calls was outweighed by my assignment to serve as a conduit for another series of telephone reports. These were from a young white Utah named Steve Holbrook. He would later go on to found KRCL, Utah Community Radio. He was caught up in the burgeoning civil rights movement in the Deep South as a Freedom Summer volunteer. Holbrook would provide detailed descriptions of his work in helping to register black voters, many of whom had been denied at the polls in previous attempts. It was my lucky experience on the rewrite desk to work with him in helping to piece his anecdotal account into coherent news stories. Contrary to the stereotype of newspaper reporting as a corrosive and cynical profession, I was often confronted with journalistic experiences that fused my questioning religious nature to current events, pushing me to examine my beliefs and ponder my life's trajectory. If I was inspired by Holbrook's immersion in a selfless and courageous work of spiritual and political significance, shouldn't it have been me on the other end of the telephone in Alabama or Mississippi rather than shackled to a typewriter in my native state? In Salt Lake's central city, I had discovered the exciting gospel choir at Calvary Baptist Church, where the Reverend France Davis was beginning his ministry. Using the primary colors of the church's stained glass as metaphor, I had written a feature story on the choir and congregation that probed the origins of gospel music in field shouts and hollers from the throats of slaves who had miraculously reshaped the pain and misery of their existence into an exuberant cry of praise and freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my God and be free. No more moaning, no more moaning, no more moaning over me. And before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my God and be free. Another song, Jesus Met the Woman at the Well, which I had been exposed to in the recordings of Ian and Sylvia, was for me like fresh water drawn from some hidden cavern as deep or deeper than my own LDS wellsprings. I'll fly away was an invitation to heaven difficult to resist, and 12 gates to the city, oh what a beautiful city, was a description of the New Jerusalem I would never be likely to encounter in the limited oeuvre of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Through acquaintances, I had made a friend in a young black photojournalist with a large and impressive Afro hairstyle, Darius Gray of KSL-TV News. Any of you who missed Darius and Margaret Blair Young's film last night should... And at that moment, they walk in the door. There they are. I'll read that sentence over again. Through acquaintances, I had made a friend in a young black photojournalist with a large and impressive Afro hairstyle. Darius Gray of KSL TV News. A Mormon convert, Darius would be involved in the formation and presidency of the Genesis Group, then Branch, which provided black Mormons a tentative foothold in a church where they still had no authority. Why was my friend Darius and others like him denied standing in the Church of Jesus Christ? For me, it was a stumbling block to a full-bodied faith. What, if anything, could be done about it? Looking up from a story I was writing one late summer afternoon in the old Deseret News City Room on Richard Street, I watched the familiar portly figure of Leonard Arrington, accompanied by a fresh-faced young man who looked like he might have been in his teens, carry in two large cardboard boxes. As the packages were opened on the city editor's desk, out spilled copies of a new journal with a striking navy blue cover. A funny and flamboyant intern at the Deseret News. Oops, skip the paragraph. Here it comes. The baby face of the younger man belonged to Eugene England, a Stanford graduate student. And the new publication was called Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. Any of us lucky enough to be there that day got a free copy. It would take a while for anyone to realize that the ground had shifted under the tentative and delicate enterprise of Mormon intellectual inquiry. A funny and flamboyant intern at the News that summer was a young man named Larry Bush, the irreverent flip side of his serious brother Lester, who I wouldn't meet until years later, a physician in Washington, D.C., with a reputation as a historian and scholar. Lester Bush was to become a key figure in further harrowing the ground for change in the LDS Church. It would be another 6 years before Bush would publish Mormonism's Negro Doctrine, a historical overview in the brash new journal Dialogue. The definitive article would help push the church's priesthood ban for blacks onto a front burner where it would simmer until a policy change in 1978. Enter Steve Hale, a Deseret News reporter and later columnist who sat at the next desk to mine in the newsroom. Hale, a Mormon convert from Georgia with an engaging southern drawl, was a gifted writer with a capacity for getting under the surface of the people he met. He had a talent for encouraging news sources to tell their own stories. It was Hale's story that was intriguing to me. A born and bred southerner whose natural inclination and identification was not with the oppressors in his culture, but with the oppressed. His friendships extended to his darker-skinned neighbors and acquaintances near his birthplace. In finding their own voices, many of them had stood up to swell the wave that would eventually sweep African Americans into full participation in this country's democracy. Not many of these people had a connection with Mormonism, but Hale knew them nonetheless. In addition, many of Hale's white Mormon colleagues in Georgia were resistant to the change, to the push for civil rights. Yet Hale, who had marched on occasion with close associates of Martin Luther King and had a wealth of stories to recount about the heroism of ordinary individuals in the movement, seemed equally comfortable in a double role, Mormon elder and advocate for equality. In Hale, I recognized a unique individual who would fuse the national events unfolding in newspapers and on the TV screens of the young people in MIA with their own developing idealism and religious commitments. If Hale would agree to come to my MN and Gleaner class as a guest speaker, his story could illuminate the spiritual roots of an unfolding piece of American history. In addition, he could bring the movement's leader, Martin Luther King, through the front door with him, if not in the flesh, at least unsmuggled. As a relevant character in the drama, he would relate. As I recall, Hale's presentation for my class was a rich and intricate weave of people, places, and events, a colorful tapestry of his experiences with young and old, black and white, Mormon and non-Mormon, obscure and well-known. The pattern he wove also contained his own conversion to the LDS Church. While Hale mentioned King, the man I so admired, he turned out to be only one of many faces in this crowded coming-of-age odyssey. In a dramatic Georgia landscape, followed by a subsequent unexpected change of scene to the Mormon quarter of the Mountain West, in any event, my guest speaker was a consummate storyteller. Despite a somewhat different script than I had expected, Hale's appearance had proven an unqualified success. Exhilarated by his warmth, spontaneity, and humor, the eminent gleaners eagerly asked questions following his remarks. Perhaps overconfident from this experience, I would later experiment with invitations to a series of more diverse and challenging guests. My intention had become to expose young, inquiring minds to wider economical horizons of hope and idealism. Meanwhile, the most ambitious of these projects was already percolating in my optimistic and rather naive consciousness. Looking back from the current perspective of a more correlated and regimented church, I'm not sure of the source of my audacity. Maybe it was a spirit of innovation and freedom I had absorbed from the 1960s, had something to do with the fortunate approbation of a young and trusting bishop. His name was Ben Banks, who decades later would be called at the General Authority. It could have been a sense of misplaced entitlement as a semi-autonomous individual in a loosely structured organization. The bishop had asked me to write and direct a roadshow for the ward. Many of our ward members were working class, low or moderate income, living in modest homes in an inner city environment. Some of their neighbors were black, Hispanic, or of other minority races. Many of the young people in MIA who were students, held fast food jobs or were looking for employment. Integration was a concept not yet fully accepted or even understood, and most of the virtually all-white Mormon kids had few, if any, minority friends, although they attended some of the same schools. In a burst of brash and possibly misguided enthusiasm, I had asked a news source of mine, who ran an anti-poverty program in the inner city, if he might be willing to recruit a few non-Mormon kids to participate in a Mormon roadshow aimed at bridging religious and racial barriers. Non-Mormon John Flores, a man of boundless faith and energy, recently he's been writing a column in the Deseret News. He might be almost as old as me, which is pretty damn old. But he's still active. Who recently reemerged? John Flores said he would try to find these kids. Although I had already discussed the roadshow script with the eminent gleaners and explained my plans for its production a week earlier, there was excitement as well as tension in the small Relief Society room where we met on a particular Tuesday evening in the late summer of 1967. The Ninth Ward, a small gray stucco structure on a narrow lot just south of 400 South on the west side of 500 East in a mixed residential and commercial neighborhood, was unimposing. A Goodyear tire store has now replaced that building. Expectant faces of class members swiveled to inspect the strangers who had entered the room and had chosen to sit in the back. The faces of the four or five young men and two or three young women were all black. The guests were shy, apprehensive, and polite. Stripped to its bare essentials, as all roadshow scripts once were, the sentimentalized and oversimplified plot I had constructed featured neighboring families, one Mormon and white, the other non-Mormon and black, getting to know each other. Young daughters in the two families, both in the bloom of new romance with young men, would become friends and catalysts for change. The music would be current pop songs, the lyrics replaced by new words to help tell the story. We used that fatally sanguine first Tuesday together to pass out copies of the scripts and to begin to cast the speaking and singing parts in the show. As I recall, Bishop Banks, who knew of our plans, dropped in to look things over. With the bishop's approval, the direction of the show had been passed to a young woman new in the ward that summer in preparation for attending the University of Utah in the fall. The fact that I'd begun dating the director seemed a good omen at that time. We didn't know the roadshow would soon hit a huge chuckle, seemingly recover, then leave the highway for a final breakdown in an ecclesiastical barrel pit. Its collapse would cause the first crisis of my relationship with the director, a bond that would survive and eventually extend to marriage, but finally divorce after 27 years. That's another story and a sadder one. The final hint of trouble for the show was the word from Bishop Banks. Just to make sure the project was okay with state leadership, he had asked for the state president's blessing to go ahead. He seemed confident there wouldn't be a hitch. A night or two later, the word came back that the state president was passing the decision up the line to the area presidency. Shortly thereafter, a crestfallen Bishop Banks informed me that the dilemma had been bumped up the chain of authority to Delbert Stapley of the Council of the Twelve, and that Elder Stapley had decided such a show would reflect negatively on the church. How could that be? Was there some sort of misunderstanding? It's been too long for me to remember if it was sheer impulsivity or stubborn intransigence that next morning caused me to show up at the old church office building on South Temple. What was the address there? 47 East South Temple. Yeah, used to be a like a euphemism for the church, 47 East South Temple. I was informed that Elder Stapley was out of town. I'm not sure which is more surprising, that I seized the moment to ask to see President Hugh B. Brown, or the fact that I was actually ushered into his office. Even before I spoke, his presence was both calming and encouraging. His mane of white hair, carefully kept, spectacles on his craggy face, and his countenance, which I still picture vividly, as intelligent, masculine, and relaxed. "Of course," he said when I described the show to him. "That sounds like something we ought to do." He would pass the word down to the stake and ward leaders. Relieved and grateful, I did not think of this generous action as a game of one-upsmanship among general authorities until several days later, when I was told Elder Stapley had returned from town and informed of the revert and was informed of the reversal. With President Brown out of town himself at this point, Stapley made a couple of phone calls and commandeered the decision. By then, we had held only one initial meeting with the joint cast and a preliminary rehearsal. The obligation fell to me to telephone cast members individually and tell them the show had been canceled. How blind and idealism can sometimes be. A risk is a risk, but a show that closes before it can even get on the road leaves a bitter taste. I had to realize, however, that the impact for me was minimal compared to the group of kids I had somehow set up to fail, particularly our volunteers recruited from the neighborhood. They couldn't have been expected to fathom the complications of decision-making by LDS church leadership. Our anticipatory highs may have reached higher, but their lows, fueled by perceptions of discrimination and rejection, must have plummeted even lower. Meeting with the LDS kids at MIA was tough enough. They didn't understand either, and I couldn't explain it to them. Afterward, the director and I drove to Memory Grove to grieve, and despite my acquaintance with the blues, which can be experienced as carrying their own balm, they did not console me that night. We sat in the car and cried. Again, from Martin Luther King, "When the storms are disappointing, or of disappointment rage, winds of disasters blow, and the tidal waves of grief beat against our lives. If we do not have a deep and patient faith, our emotional lives will be ripped to shreds. Martin King's words didn't come to me that night, and only in retrospect did it occur to me they were applicable. I was too young then to have developed a patient faith. And in honesty, I'm not sure if I've yet acquired the patience he advised. And another hero of mine, with a way with words, closer to the earth, less lofty, perhaps, than King, had written a song that put it this way. If I could be the rain, I'd wash down to the sea. If I could be the wind, there'd be no more of me. If I could be the sunlight and all the days were mine, I would find some special place to shine. But all the rain I'll ever be is locked up in my eyes. When I hear the wind, it only whispers sad goodbyes. If I could hide the way I feel, I'd never sing again. Sometimes I wish that I could be the rain. Labor activist, singer-songwriter Bruce Utah Phillips died in May this year, just 3 months ago. He was approximately my age, a man who rode in boxcars with hobos and on Friday nights in the 1960s sang for bums at the Joe Hill House of Hospitality. Was a veteran of the Korean War, but he came home from combat to oppose all killing. Strangely, you may think, I invited Phillips to come and sing for the MN and Gleaners. Somehow, his music seemed an appropriate antidote for grief. His flintiness had an impact with young Mormon kids, whose only acquaintance probably with folk music at that time was the Kingston Trio. On another occasion, we sat on the floor and packed that Ninth Ward Relief Society room to hear Polly and the Valley Boys, the bluegrass group Phillips had whipped together with Polly Stewart, perform. Another time, he brought Rosalie Sorrells with him, the Idaho transplant who sojourned on 2nd Avenue in Salt Lake City. An extension of Highway 40 had directed almost every American folk artist of note to her door over the years. Rosalie, the storied legend of the Nancy Griffith song, Ford Econoline, cared enough about LDS neighbors, she was herself not Mormon, her LDS neighbors to teach them their own legacy with an album of Mormon folk songs. Riskiest of all on my MIA guest list was Ammon Hennessy. In Ammon's case, MIA could have stood for missing in action. Hennessy was the only American in history to serve time in prison during both world wars for a refusal to register for the draft. A Catholic anarchist pacifist, he had served with Dorothy Day in the Catholic Workers Movement. After laboring in the fields with migrant workers across the country, he spent his last days in Utah picketing against capital punishment and running the Joe Hill House. Here he made friends with many Mormons, including Neil A. Maxwell, and wrote about the Latter-day Saints and their history in a chapter of his autobiography, The Book of Ammon. When I hear the scriptural passages, "Blessed are the meek, turn the other cheek, and a soft answer turneth away wrath," I think of Ammon, then a living example of those virtues and one who taught me their deeper meanings. In prison, Hennessy had survived so many beatings meant to intimidate him, he had lost all fear. Stepping up to knock him down on picket lines, assorted bruisers with distorted patriotism were startled. As he looked them in the eye, they saw he wasn't frightened and they couldn't hit him. In asking him to come and speak, I had decided it was important for the young Mormons to see Jesus' words written on the face of an old man of another faith. He also had a sense of humor, and the MN Gleaners loved him. In the strength of love, Martin Luther King Jr. had said, "The hope of a secure and livable world lies with disciplined nonconformists who are dedicated to justice, peace, and brotherhood." He added, The good neighbor looks beyond the external accidents and discerns those inner qualities that make all men human and therefore brothers. In the painstaking development of my own fragile faith, curious encounters with King, Hennessy, the MN Gleaners, and all the others who shaped my life in the 1960s, black and white, Mormon and non-Mormon, could have seemed like beads on a string of coincidence. Over the years, I realized they resembled miracles. Whatever I had learned about being human started with many of my neighbors in the inner city. More recently, another strange encounter had more to teach me. Deseret News religion columnist Jerry Johnston had been critical of my book of poems, Ice That the Ward Burned at the Stake. At lunch, when we talked about his objections, one anomaly he pointed out to me was my attraction to the rhythms and imagery of the blues and of black gospel music. How could such a cultural incongruity be central to my religious convictions? After all, he said, "You're just a white boy from Logan." Although I was initially distressed by this comment, the kick in the pants was something I needed. It pushed me toward introspection and a re-examination of who I had become. Today, it may seem maybe appropriate to thank Jerry Johnston. His phrase stuck in my head and led to a poem. References to several black gospel and blues musicians, Hudie Ledbetter, a.k.a. Leadbelly, Bessie Smith, and Jesse Fuller, appear in this poem, along with the Christian names of four young children among the first martyrs of the civil rights struggle in the South. White boy from Logan. Lugs milk in gallon jugs from dairy at the agricultural college. Breaks one in spectacular crash of glass on concrete. All that butterfat from Cache Valley cows munching on sweet grass, meant to feed family of immigrant Swedes, spills from College Hill. Spills down College Hill from Old Main. No bread and milk for supper that night. White boy learns to cry. Not for spilled milk, but for the sad, familiar pallor of his stoic ilk. In a place where a dark face is stranger than a shadow, where even tan is suspect, he burns for unfamiliar warmth and color. Eventually, he climbs the hill for understanding. When hatred kills, he's branded by the times, 2,000 miles away in Birmingham, where Southern Sun lights Sunday school. Four black children, Carol, Cynthia, Denise, and Addie Mae, blaze into memory. White fool in turquoise Chevrolet plants dynamite. Then white boy learns to cry again. Music takes him stranger places. In D.C. with Hootie, sees the faces of the bourgeoisie, throw a colored man a nickel just to see him bow. With Bessie, goes to church on Sunday, sings the shimmy down on Monday in Frisco, brand new day with Jesse out beside the bay. One last journey over Jordan that he can't refuse. White boy from Logan learns to cry the blues. Thank you.
I am completely unqualified to respond to Paul's paper. I'm not a poet. I'm not a writer. I don't sing the blues. I don't know the blues. But they asked me to respond nevertheless, so I'm going to give it my best shot. There are two things that came to mind when I was reading your paper. Lots of questions that some of your issues raised for me. Your story of your encounter with Hubie Brown is very painful and troubling to hear. I'm very familiar with stories like that through my own parents' experiences. It certainly undermines a clear message of obedience to our leaders and that there's a clear chain of command. I imagine to someone who advocates an absolute obedience to your leaders, this story must just drive them crazy. How do you reconcile it? What do you do? What is the proper way to respond to it? And it, you know, it just, for me, I'm just like thinking of all these, you know, implications of it. Do you follow the first counsel or the second counsel, or do you, you know, raise a ruckus and say, wait a minute, you know, someone of more seniority, or but what's even more troubling to me is what I expect from my leaders. What does it mean to be a leader? Because your bishop is supposed to be your leader and set an example for you. And yet every single person all the way to the very top shirked their responsibility as a leader. My understanding of a leader is someone who doesn't ask questions of permission. They take a stand for something. They set an example. They take risks. They're on the vanguard. They're showing the way. And then they invite you to follow, and that's why we look to them and support them as leaders, because we have confidence in them. But in terms of taking a stand and not asking questions, I guess that makes Bush one of the greatest leaders we've ever had. But all of those men in authority ruled or were leaders out of fear. Fear of what might happen. So they sought somebody else's directive. Rather than take responsibility for the play, they passed it on to somebody else, and passed it on. And ultimately, with Brother Stapley, Elder Stapley, his decision was based on fear, not out of what could happen, but what might not happen, or might happen that would overrule whatever positive thing would happen. Which I guess then that makes, you know, Bush amply qualified as a leader, because everything in our political and economic system is based on fear. Our politicians rule out of fear. They worry about whether they're going to get reelected, or, you know, what the polls say, or our economy is based on fear. Please buy this. If you don't buy this, you'll be insecure. You'll be unhappy. If you buy this car, you'll be happy. And they play on our fears. So I guess that's what's disappointing, is we expect our leaders to set an example, and be confident, and take stands, take risks. And we confide in them for that. But all of them failed in that respect. And it brings up, you know, some particular instances with my father, who was affected by men who made decisions that affected him out of fear of what might happen. As for our relationship and legitimacy in claiming the blues, our current church is too wealthy and comfortable to have any claim on the blues. Maybe people in the mission field can claim that right, given their experiences in isolation and challenges. Certainly, our 19th century history, early church history, has a claim on the blues. Come, Come, Ye Saints is about the most bluesy hymn we've ever had. I mean, you know, that's the blues, the closest thing we have to the blues. And it certainly has every right to claim that heritage and experience. But this issue raises many questions. Who owns the blues? People who are oppressed? Does that include Hispanics? because they've certainly been oppressed, maybe not to the same extent of historical extent as blacks, but they've been marginalized. But if we saw a Hispanic person singing the blues, we would think that was highly illegitimate or, you know, not, you know, culturally relevant or whatever. To me, this is just smacks of reverse racism and cultural snobbery, form of colonialism and imperialism. Elvis borrowed the blues and successfully commercialized what whites were terrified in seeing in blacks. They were terrified of seeing it in him, too, but you know, managed to cross that divide with time. Aerosmith and the Rolling Stones, the same thing. Borrowed from the blues, hybridized it, made it palatable to white culture, so to speak. They were hardly oppressed people. But, you know, unless you consider that all teenagers consider themselves oppressed people, you know, then I guess it's a legitimate claim. As an artist, I am constantly borrowing from other cultures and movements in art, all the way back to the 12th century. I'm always looking at other art movements and, like, trying to internalize them and understand them and then borrow from them. And, you know, these are coming from cultures that have very little to do with me, or, you know, at best are part of the Western art tradition, but I'm always trying to internalize them. What makes American culture so vibrant and creative and interesting is the ability to assimilate many, many different cultures and create new hybrids of those cultures. That's what rock is. Rock and roll is basically the hybridization of the blues and black culture and many different forms and making it unique to our culture. The question I have is, when is it stealing? When is it paying tribute to? And when is it merely copying another culture? If it's merely copying, it's not legitimate. It's not part of your experience. You're just reproducing what somebody else has done. And you can do that on any level, from a forger to someone who... Oh, I'm trying to think of some really, really bad cover albums. Who was... Pat Boone. I think he did some kind of cover album of rock songs or something like that. And it was just like a total joke. And it's like, you know, I guess that's the closest thing I can think of. You know, the total illegitimacy of trying to hybridize or assimilate another culture. This whole question of your friend saying you're just a white Mormon boy, it just smacks of reverse racism and political correctness and everything that I find really quite troublesome with anybody who wants to be a policeman over anyone else's right to express themselves on any level. But ultimately, it just boils down to, is it legitimate? Is it real? Is it part of who you are? And the evidence is in what you actually create out of it. But to go around trying to say you can and cannot do this or that, or say this or that, just troubles me. And I guess it harks back to the whole issue of the leadership thing is, you know, a leader doesn't go around telling people you can and cannot do things. They inspire us to do things by their example. Anyway, kind of disorganized, but hopefully that, you know, helps understand what you're talking about.
We have 10 minutes left. If there are any comments or questions, would you please step to the mic here? Mary, do you want me to just bring this over to you?
I just want to say that I think part of this problem is misunderstanding of the art form. We don't understand that a white washroom woman could feel himself into black and the blues experience. We don't understand that the novelist does that. So Jerry said to you that you can do that because he doesn't understand art. You want to comment?
I'll let you know. I think that stood on its own. Come on, Jerry.
Yes, indeed.
Janet Tobias. I'm just used to testifying at Capitol hearings, so we always have to tell our address. This is a really bad experience going to political meetings and testifying. I just wanted to say, Paul, I think that when you started the revolution, and who knows, you could have had a hand in the church leadership changing their opinion on songs. Gladys Knight. Gladys Knight, I believe she told President Hinckley that Mormons need to step up their songs. And I'm a musician, and you know they dictate in every little part of our lives. I remember the one conference where they even said, "You need to be happy when you're singing." Well, how can you be happy? I love the hymns, but now they've simplified them and they put them in the green book, and anybody who's musicians understand that they've simplified the accompaniment and then they took out the sunshine in the soul, where we used to say the happy moments roll with, you know, all the fun stuff. It's all been taken out. And I love going to other religious services because their music is so incredibly beautiful. And they wonder why people, and you go to church and everybody's not actively engaged. It's because they simplify it, they take all the fun out. And our choir director, she slipped in a black gospel song last year, and we just decided it was better to ask forgiveness and permission. We have a bishop that's not really strict on music. We called our former bishop the Taliban bishop. And, and everything we sing, I mean, we couldn't even jazz anything up, you know, one bit. And my husband is a musician, and he... with the Taliban bishop, they told him the night before that he couldn't sing his own music. My daughter's a classical pianist. She was able to play for my ward, but in her singles ward, my Taliban bishop got transferred to the singles ward. Now he's a bishop there. And he said that her classical music had to be, it was too long. It was maybe 5 minutes, and he only wanted it 3 or 4. And it was, who plays classical music anymore in Brahms? And so this really kind of gets to me, because I think that music is such a part of religious services and black spiritual music. The Mama's Faith Choir and all those, I just love listening to their music. And so I would think that you had a hand in it, Paul, and everything that we do, as you know, makes a difference. So anyway, thanks.
Amen. Hallelujah.
You know, just a follow-up to that. I lived several years in Preston, Idaho, and my co-worker, law partner, was a state president when Ezra Taft Benson died. And I didn't realize this, but his wife had been buried in Whitney, Idaho. And there was some discussion for a couple of days whether the church was going to allow President Benson to be buried there. And that's a long story, another day. But
do a paper on that for next week.
I know. It was very interesting because... But having said that, and maybe I'm over-reading into this, but I found it extremely interesting that President Hinckley's services at the graveside ended with Amazing Grace and Danny Boy. Boyd K. Packer must have been foaming, you know. But
didn't he at least mouth the words?
I don't know. But I thought that was significant and, you know, something that's contrary to a lot of what we hear and
see. Absolutely. Thank you.
I didn't plan to come up here and say anything, but I was moved by some of the comments of others and wanted to tell a story about my wife, who's a member of a group called the Denver Area Mormon Women, also known as the Dan Women. And they meet at a retreat every summer. They have on Sunday morning a spiritual meeting, which itself is going to be highly unauthorized. But they always have an old-time gospel singing time. And they have a specialist from Chicago, a lady who's just an amazing musician, who gathers things from, quote, old-time religion, from the blues, from the black experience, music, and so forth. And they just have a grand old time doing that. And I think it's a lot of fun to hear from her how much she enjoys that and how much fun it is. I personally agree with Ezra Taft Benson. I look forward to some songs that will be sung at my funeral. I told my wife, if they won't let them in the chapel, you can do them at the graveside. They can't stop you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I like your talk. It's very good. What I learned to do, because I really miss gospel music, so what I do, and I'm just a convert to the church, but what I do, I go to my friend's church, to a black church, to listen to the praise and worship, and then I run over to my church, like to the Mormon church, because I really miss that a lot, because I'm not used to, like, you know, just being at the church, and I find the music very boring. I don't need to be, you know, rude, but so I, you know, but it is very boring. So I go back and forth every Sunday, and so and then I figure, then I get what I want out of both churches.
I like that solution.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Judy Busk, and I enjoyed your presentation very much. And maybe I'd like to speak to some of the racial issues. I was raised in California. And in my elementary school, there were no black children in any of the elementary books. It was Dick and Jane and their white family. So what a progress we've made. But now we have books of so many ethnic groups. And I knew Franz Davis well because I was on the board of directors for the Utah Humanities Council when he was the president of our board, and I've been to his church. And I think music crosses boundaries. You know, it's a wonderful thing, orchestrational music. You can be in any country and listen to it and love and find a bonding. And my husband and I lived in Long Beach, California during the 1960s in an integrated neighborhood. And we had black-white dialogues at our house. And one of the men that came was the first black bus driver in Long Beach. And one of his first runs, an older woman went to get on the bus, and she stepped back and wouldn't ride the bus. And then another experience he had was a woman getting on the bus and putting a handkerchief in her hand to accept the change. And so I still remember that from, you know, so many years ago, and the emotion of it. And so my husband and I worked and did what we could. And then I was a social worker in Watts in the 1960s also. And so I wrote a book, and Signature published it, called The Sum of Our Past, Revisiting Pioneer Women. And as I kept adding to the book, I thought, well, I really need a chapter on black Mormon pioneers. And so I put a chapter in and entitled it Black Hills. They all have geographical title. And I'm really indebted to Margaret and Darius because I quoted from their first book. But in it, I told about my experience in an integrated but not integrated high school, and I told about my social work experience and my elementary experience. And I just finished the second book in the series, and I just loved it. I was so touched by it, and I feel like we might get discouraged sometimes, but oh, things are so much better. And my children, and I taught high school for 25 years, my students, you know, I used black book, you know, Book to Kill a Mockingbird for an example, or other books like that, and various ethnic groups. And so we are making progress. And if we can learn to love people for the commonalities that we have, and that was one thing I tried to stress in my book with all different groups. But anyway, I'm grateful for your comments, and my heart is with you because of my own experiences. Thank you.
And I'm with you.
One more quick question.
Comment. Just when Darius and I were starting our books, because I'm a white kid from Provo, which is even slightly worse than being a white kid from Logan. The way that he helped prepare me to do what we were going to do was to record all of the music that his mother had played and he had the record albums that she had played in the, what was that, 1910, 1920?
Yeah, thank you.
No, 30s and, 30s and 40s, 30s, but, 40s. You know, Blind Boys of Alabama, and, the music that Elsie Gray would listen to while she was doing housework until she couldn't stand it anymore and she'd have to sit down at the piano and play. And I listened to that over and over and over again to get not just... I did, by the end of things, I had all of the lyrics memorized, but just the feeling of the culture that we were entering into as we, because we did write about his parents, and to feel what Elsie, what made Elsie love life, and the music was so integral in all of that. And of course, it's a part of my family's life, it's a part of my children's life. That's
you gotta
how we live now.
Yep.
Okay, our time's up. Thank you very much for coming.